Greetings, Tabernacle Baptist Church, members and guests alike. It is June 2020, and whether you have been a lifelong member of Tabernacle or are just stumbling upon this podcast out of the blue, we are so glad you're listening. My name is Art Wright. My wife Beth and I are members at Tabernacle, and I'm a New Testament scholar here in Richmond, Virginia. This is the first episode of a podcast series on the New Testament book of Revelation. We're going to do 5 or 6 of these episodes, depending on how it goes. And the idea is that we have this sense that we're living in some sort of apocalyptic moment right now, given the context of the pandemic. And we'll unpack that a little bit later. But my hunch is that by trying to understand Revelation in its historical context, we may see ways in which Revelation still speaks to us in a revelatory manner in our own context today. And my hope is that by reading it, it will help us better understand what it means to follow Christ in this moment of time and what it means to be the church in this moment. And so I have a special guest joining me today as we introduce the book of Revelation and wade into the deep waters here. I have Dr. Mitchell Reddish, who is joining us from Florida, and we are talking via Zoom, so we are observing appropriate social distancing protocols. Although, Mitchell, I'm not too sure that Florida is too strict on those right now, are they?
Not as strict as they should be.
Yeah, probably not. For our podcast listeners, Mitchell is famous and widely known for being my father-in-law. Would you say that's pretty accurate?
That's my largest claim to fame.
That's right. When he's not spending time being an awesome grandparent to my children, Mitchell is a professor at Stetson University in DeLand, Florida. And he has spent a great deal of his academic career studying the book of Revelation. So, Mitchell, we are so grateful for you joining us today.
Good. Glad to be here.
Yeah. So I wonder if you can help us sort of wade gently into Revelation. What do you think comes to mind for people typically when they think about the book of Revelation? What are some of the sort of general impressions that people tend to have of this book?
My experience has been most people are usually afraid of the book because they see it as filled with pictures of doom and gloom, or they get excited about it because they think it gives them all the details about the end of the world. And there's a little bit of truth in each of those descriptions, but unfortunately, both represent a not very good understanding of what's going on with the book of Revelation.
Yeah, doom and gloom or excitement, that this gives us this sort of like perfect map of how the end of time is going to play out, right?
Correct.
My hunch is that in both of those cases, the people that have those assumptions don't actually spend a lot of time reading the actual book.
A few years back when I taught a course on apocalyptic literature at Stetson, an undergraduate course, one of the assignments I gave the students was that they had to sit down and read the whole book of Revelation and then write what their reaction was to it. And one student, I thought, gave a great answer. She said, I was surprised by what was not in the book of Revelation that had always been told was in the book. So it was a very eye-opening experience for her to finally sit down and read it. And she found that it wasn't filled with a lot of the details that she had always been taught were in the book of Revelation.
I'm assuming, I love that she sort of came away with that response. I have been similar. In New Testament classes, I've had students express surprise for what they have discovered in the New Testament,
yes.
Especially some of the stuff that Paul says in 1 Corinthians. But yeah, so I mean, my sense is that a lot of people get their assumptions about Revelation from the Left Behind series, Kirk Cameron, sort of a terrible B-rate movie decades ago now. But that's a lot of that's just not in the book of Revelation, right?
Correct. And my flippant comment about that whole series is if you go to the library, it's shelved in the science fiction section. So or at least the fiction section of the library, and that's the best way to approach that whole series. That's not a good guide to how to interpret the Book of Revelation.
Yes, fiction for sure, yeah. So help us. So I hear you saying, you know, on the one hand, there are folks that don't want to touch the Book of Revelation with a 10-foot pole, and the other hand, some people have this, you know, maybe almost unhealthy, obsessive fascination with it. I'm not going to ask you to, you know, type yourself. I know you wrote a commentary on the book. Yeah. I wonder if you can help us sort of think about it from church history. What sort of place has the Book of Revelation held in church history?
Revelation's had a very checkered history in terms of how it has been viewed and appreciated by Christian readers from the very earliest times up through the fourth century. Although it was inconsistent, the kind of general attitude toward the Book of Revelation among churches in the western part of Christianity is the book was generally accepted. Churches in the east generally rejected the Book of Revelation for a variety of reasons. Often it was because of theological ideas they found in the book that they did not like. Some reacted to the violent imageries in the Book of Revelation. And for some, the Book of Revelation supported ideas they didn't like. So for a variety of reasons, the Book of Revelation really had a difficult time making it into the canon. And the New Testament canon kind of reached its final state around the fourth century. And even beyond that, Revelation continued to suffer from a variety of different approaches to how you interpret these strange images that show up in the Book of Revelation. Martin Luther, for example, his famous statement was, "Christ is not known or taught in it." Although his one of his versions of the New Testament had more illustrations in the Book of Revelation than any other book, a series of woodcuts. So even though his most famous line, as I said, is that Christ is not known or taught in it, and so thus he saw it was not one that one should spend a lot of time with, he still had kind of a love-hate relationship with the book as well.
Yeah, fascinating. And I'm recalling, I went to a Presbyterian seminary, so John Calvin evidently wrote a commentary on every book of scripture except for Revelation, right? So we see
that's right, yes,
in terms of another Protestant reformer is sort of holding the book at arm's length. Any, I don't know if you know this answer or not, but any idea why Revelation was included in the canon? What was sort of the you know, the linchpin that pushed it, you know, for acceptance, especially in the Western church, as you were saying?
Well, I think one of the reasons has to do with the question of authorship. There was an early tradition, kind of a confused tradition in the history of the church, that identified the author of the Book of Revelation with the same person who authored the Gospel of John, which was thought to be the Apostle John. A lot of problems with all of those assumptions, as you know, but because of that tradition that the author of the Book of Revelation was the Apostle John, that was one of the big factors that helped it get into the book. One of the other factors in general that applied to books being accepted in the canon was widespread usage, and the Book of Revelation was popular among a good many Christians in the early church, so that contributed. And it, you know, even if you push Martin Luther's later comment aside that Christ is not known or taught in it, which is kind of a strange comment on his part, because Book of Revelation does have a very high Christology, that is a very high valuation of the importance of Christ. And so I think that there's some powerful theological aspects of the book that contributed to it being accepted.
That's fantastic. Yeah, and I mean, the figure of Christ really does hold a central place of importance in the book.
Right.
Maybe in a way that he doesn't in some of the other books of scripture.
Yeah, I think the Book of Revelation probably has one of the highest Christological understandings of any book in the New Testament, because a lot of the titles that the author applies to God, he also applies to the Christ figure. Mm-hmm. So even though he never makes the two one, they're still separate entities for him. He can describe God as the Alpha and the Omega. He can describe Christ in the same way. So even though if we had John of Patmos, the author, here and tried to pin him down in terms of 20 centuries of Christian theology, how would you define the Trinity? I think he would stumble around the same way most of us do. But in spite of that, he had a very high estimation of who Christ was.
Right. It strikes me that, you know, the book starts the revelation of Jesus Christ, right? The first few words. And then he is someone worthy of worship throughout the book of Revelation. So I love that you mention widespread usage as this sort of criteria for inclusion in the canon. And for many of us, especially in sort of moderate Baptist circles, we don't encounter revelation on a regular basis. So we don't tend to see that much widespread usage in some circles. It doesn't necessarily show up in the lectionary very often. You know, most of our pastors probably don't choose sermon series on revelation all that often. But from what I know, even though we aren't that familiar with revelation, a lot of us end up singing it in church. Is that right? Can you speak to us a little bit more about the use of revelation in the context of worship, even today?
Yeah, I will preface that by agreeing with your comment about many people grow up not being that familiar with it in worship. My own experience was I grew up in a very traditional mainline Southern Baptist county seat church. I can't remember ever hearing a sermon on the book of Revelation in my home church. It was not a functional part of the canon with which I grew up. I first encountered the book of Revelation to any real extent was when I was a seminary student and happened to take a course from someone who was an expert on the book of Revelation. And his approach to it really intrigued me and helped me see the value of that book. But your question is also important because in the sense of we encounter the book of Revelation in worship, because the book of Revelation itself is imbued with worship. Throughout the book of Revelation, worship is at the center of who John is and what his presentation is. You've got John's vision of the 24 elders and the four living creatures and the others falling down in worship for God. One of the central passages for the book of Revelation comes in chapters 4 and 5, where you have the throne scene of God with those who are there worshiping God. And for John, worship is important because, and we can talk some more about this later, but worship for John is really a political act because in worship, one is declaring to whom one owes allegiance. And so worship is central to what the book of Revelation is about. So it's significant, I think, that when we encounter the book of Revelation, we often encounter it in worship. The other thing to mention there is that for the earliest hearers of the book of Revelation, and they were likely hearers, not readers of the book, they would have encountered the book in a worship setting, as this writing was probably carried around to the seven churches and would have been read to a small gathered group of people in worship. So the original context of the book of Revelation is worship. We have several hymns that are connected to the book of Revelation. Probably the most famous one would be Holy, Holy, Holy. That line that is used in the book of Revelation that shows up there in that hymn, originally at least those three opening words come from the book of Isaiah. You have other hymns that perhaps use a phrase or two from the book of Revelation, as well as some hymns that we probably, for good reason, don't sing as much anymore that have some connection to the book of Revelation, such as When We All Get to Heaven and other such hymns. So the book of Revelation has contributed to the music of the church in some very powerful ways. Probably for most of your listeners, one of the most powerful uses of text from the book of Revelation is not in music that we use as frequently in church, but one they're familiar with is Handel's Messiah. Not only the Hallelujah Chorus, but other passages that show up in that musical work are drawn from the book of Revelation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's fantastic. Many of us sing Revelation even when we don't realize it.
That's correct.
And I won't ask you to comment on this, but Beth has told me in the past that, you know, you would used to like point over at the words of the hymn and tell her when that's Revelation.
That's right.
I've sort of started doing that too now that, you know, she lives in Richmond and, you know, she doesn't have you there on a weekly basis to do that.
Yeah. Well, and another example, one of Charles Wesley's great hymns, Oh for a Thousand Tongues to Sing. Uh-huh. That's drawing that imagery from the book of Revelation.
Yeah.
So over and over we can find passages from the book of Revelation that show up in the hymns that we sing.
Right. Anything about dealing with casting crowns, which is sort of an image of loyalty and allegiance. Yep. That shows up in hymns sometimes.
Worthy is the Lamb.
Right.
Is another one. So there are numerous hymns that are indebted to the book of Revelation. So not only do we read the text, we sing the text in worship.
Yeah. Well, I love that you say that worship is political too, and we'll certainly sort of try to draw on those themes. I often try to highlight for Sunday school class and also students that faith itself, the Greek word for faith, pistis, doesn't simply mean like, I intellectually believe in something, but it does suggest something more akin to loyalty and allegiance. And that comes through in the depictions of worship in Revelation too.
Yes.
So I think for the churches that have gravitated toward Revelation in recent history or in the last 100 years or so, the most popular way of reading it has been what we might call dispensationalist or premillennialist readings. Can you tell us a little bit more about sort of what those perspectives are and how they understand and approach Revelation?
Yeah, that represents an approach to the book of Revelation that sees the book as a book filled with predictions, literal predictions of things that are yet to come, in which from that vantage point, their belief is if you're a keen observer of what's going on in the world today, you can find that predicted in the book of Revelation. And thus, with the usually the assistance of charts and timetables, you can figure out where we are in church history and when the end is coming. The problem with that approach is people have been doing that throughout church history, where they have found things going on in history that seem to match up with a statement in the book of Revelation and take that as evidence that the author was predicting literally events to come, which is not the appropriate way to deal with the book of Revelation. Mm-hmm. I was channel flipping yesterday, in fact, and landed on one such approach in which the person was claiming that the coronavirus is evidence of one of the events of the end time, because this is one of the plagues and pestilences that's ravaging the world that's touched on in the book of Revelation. And the purpose of the book of Revelation is not to try and give us detailed predictions. It is a general statement. On the one hand, a statement of hope and affirmation, but also a challenge
to
Christian readers. The approach that you're talking about, the dispensationalist or premillennialist approach, and actually there are about as many variations of those as there are people who adhere to them. But you could be a pre-tribulation premillennialist or a post-tribulation premillennialist or a mid-trib premillennialist.
Right.
So it all gets very complicated. And unfortunately, as I said, those approaches owe more to the creative ability of the interpreter than actually what's going on in the text. And one of the problems with those approaches is they read into the text rather than try and read what is in the text itself.
Mm-hmm. We look at what's going on in the world and then try to find something that it connects to in the text.
Correct.
Yeah. So, Mitchell, this would be like Hal Lindsey, Late Great Planet Earth, the authors of the Left Behind series. And I'm even thinking Harold Camping is back in 2012 was sort of a right. famous, you know, prediction about the end of the world where they traveled the country, you know, trying to I guess, share the news, the end is coming. And then it didn't come, and then they re-predicted it, and it still didn't come. And that's sort of been the crux of the matter for, I guess, a lot of
yeah, these. And if you look back through church history is littered with people who have taken that approach, and their predictions, unfortunately, have proven to be incorrect. The world is still here, and it keeps going. And you know, the approach of many of those is when the end doesn't come as they have predicted, then they go back and refigured and find a mistake they made and give you a new prediction.
Right.
There's really nothing new about that approach. We can go back thousands of years and find examples of that.
Well, my concern is that, you know, if you have that sort of perspective, it can lead to this sort of escapist mentality where, you know, Jesus is coming back soon. It doesn't matter what we do in the world, you know, in terms of our lives or the environment, if we think that the world is going to end soon, it might undercut our ability to think long-term in terms of, you know, ethics and what it means to build a just society.
Correct. Everything from not wanting to be concerned about the environment. If you believe the world's going to end soon, why worry about whether species die off or
right.
we ruin the world with climate change? The same thing with society. If you think the world is going to end soon, why worry about changing society? So that is certainly one of the deleterious effects of having the view that the world is about to end, and that's what the book of Revelation is literally predicting.
Mm-hmm. Well, when I talk to classes, one of the things I always say is this sort of reading fundamentally misunderstands the genre of Revelation, and that is apocalyptic literature. So I wonder if we can spend a little bit of time on unpacking what apocalyptic literature is, because that will help us understand Revelation, as Revelation is sort of the paradigmatic example of apocalyptic literature in Scripture.
As you said, Revelation belongs to the category of apocalyptic literature. And one of our problems with reading the book of Revelation is we're not familiar with that type of literature. There is only one full-blown example in the Hebrew Bible or Old Testament of apocalyptic literature, and that's the book of Daniel. Mm-hmm. And that's probably not a book that most people read too often either. The book of Revelation is the only full-blown example that we have of apocalypse in the New Testament. And so we're kind of limited in terms of our familiarity with that particular type of literature. And, you know, the same way that you don't read a comic book, the same way you read a history book, you wouldn't want to read the book of Revelation the same way you read the Gospels. There are different genres.
Right.
John's audience would have been much more familiar with that type of literature than we are, because apocalyptic literature was relatively popular, at least in certain segments of Judaism, up through about the second century after Christ. We have about 13 or 14 different examples of Jewish apocalyptic writings from about 3rd century BCE up until 2nd century CE. It became very popular as well in Christianity. The writings continued, apocalyptic literature continued in early Christianity for about another 10 or 11 centuries or so that we have examples from. And we have over 20 examples of apocalyptic literature from that time period that are Christian writings.
Wow.
one of the major characteristics of apocalyptic literature is it's what's called revelatory literature, meaning it is attempting to reveal something that has supposedly been revealed to a human recipient. So it is revelation that claims to have information that's not available to the average or ordinary person. In John's case, that is the author of the book of Revelation, John claims that this was a message that Christ gave him to deliver to the churches. So that's one of the characteristics of this, which makes it different from, say, whoever wrote the Gospel of Mark, for example. That individual does not claim that this was a special message delivered to him. He's simply trying to convey his understanding of who Jesus of Nazareth was. One of the other characteristics of apocalyptic literature is that this revelation is revealed to a human recipient, usually through some supernatural figure. Usually there is an angel who supposedly reveals the message to the writer of the text, or there are angel guides or interpreters who provide this. And you certainly see that in the book of Revelation, where there are both angelic figures who relay messages as well as interpret messages for John in the book of Revelation. One of the other characteristics of the book of Revelation is that revelation often arose during a time of crisis. Now, we have to be a little careful here because we admit we don't really know the background for a lot of the apocalyptic text. But for many of them, for which we can surmise what the historical or sociological setting for the writing was, they do seem to have arisen during some time of crisis, either a political crisis, a historical crisis, or sometimes maybe a theological crisis. And the books are written in response to that particular situation.
Yeah, I'm thinking, I mean, this is years ago now that I read it, but is it the Testament of Abraham that sort of deals with the sort of universal crisis of death?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's one of my favorite apocalyptic texts. There's a lot of humor in that writing, but it is really dealing with that theological crisis of death, I think, is
right.
What that work is struggling with.
Yeah. Is there we can maybe talk some other specifics of Revelation later, but what do scholars typically surmise as the crisis confronting the author of Revelation?
Well, for Revelation, the crisis is living in Asia Minor during the latter part of the first century in a society and an environment that is not primarily Christian, and that at times was antagonistic to Christianity. We have to be careful not to overstate that. Sometimes people get the idea that Christians were widely and heavily persecuted even during the first century. We have very little evidence of that. There is some evidence of that, but more than official persecution, what there would have been societal pressures to conform to the larger Greco-Roman world, in which there were many gods and goddesses that were worshipped, and for someone to be a success in that society, you would have wanted to fit in.
Right.
In addition to worshiping the various other gods and goddesses, emperor worship was strong, particularly in Asia Minor. And there would have been, again, societal pressure to participate in emperor worship. And that certainly comes out in the book of Revelation.
And so if you are, you know, working a trade, you might join a trade guild that is dedicated to the Greek or Roman god, like Dionysius, perhaps, or
yes,
or if you attend a festival, you know, sort of a citywide festival, it may be honoring the emperor and his family or something. And so there's this tension that Christians have to wrestle with. If we believe that Jesus is Lord, can I still participate in these other things that ask me to acknowledge these other deities?
Yeah, and the pressure, I think, for Christians living in Asia Minor in the first century would have been at times subtle pressure and at times overt pressure to participate in all the cities that we have mentioned in the book of Revelation, those seven cities in Asia Minor. We do know that emperor worship was rather strong in those areas. And emperor worship itself was a pretty fairly developed cult system in first century Roman world. There were temples that were built to honor the temples, to honor the emperors, and cities vied for the honor of having a temple to an inner, to an emperor in their city. That area in Asia Minor where, or what is modern day Turkey, where the seven cities were located, was one of the areas that where emperor worship was particularly strong. Out of those seven cities, there have been remains of temples or at least imperial altars found in at least five of those seven cities. There were festivals held to honor the emperors. There were hymns that were sung to the emperors. So it would have been hard to be particularly a leading member of society. If you were someone, a Christian living in Asia Minor and wanted to improve your social standing, it would have been hard, I think, to avoid participating in the civic acts that honored the emperor.
So it may be socially and economically disadvantageous to be faithful to Christ.
Yes.
Yeah. So we're talking about apocalyptic literature as crisis literature. What I hear you saying sort of takes me into another sort of central feature of apocalyptic literature, that it's resistance literature, right?
Yeah, one of the ways to describe apocalyptic literature in general, and specifically, say, the Book of Daniel and the Book of Revelation, is to see these as literature that whose intent is to offer both protest and comfort. There are certainly writings that are attempting to offer comfort for people who find themselves in the crisis situation. But on the other hand, they are also writings that are calling on people to resist and protest against what they see as illegitimate claims to sovereignty, particularly for the author of the Book of Revelation. John lived in a world in which Rome was seen as supreme. Rome was the one to whom honor was due, because Rome was the one that provided food, provided peace and security, provided good highways. Rome, as the great goddess, was the one to be worshipped and honored. What John is trying to do, one of the things he's trying to do in the Book of Revelation, is to say, resist that understanding, because out of our Christian conviction, we would say that the only one who is worthy of that kind of honor and worship is God alone. And so it is resistance in that larger sense. What John is trying to do is give them a different way of viewing reality. Whereas it looks like Rome is in charge, John is saying, let's pull back the curtain and we'll see that it's really, in John's language, it is Satan that's calling the shots, and that the emperor is simply a pawn of Satan. And even if you look at the Book of Daniel in the Old Testament, it's a similar situation. There, obviously, it's not the Roman Empire, but in the time of the author of the Book of Daniel, it was Antiochus Epiphanes, who was the Hellenistic Syrian ruler who was oppressing the Jews and outlawing the practice of Judaism. And so the author of the Book of Daniel is calling them to resist that idea that Antiochus Epiphanes is the one who is the all-powerful one, in kind of a I think, humorous way of getting back at Antiochus Epiphanes. He describes him as only a little horn. He thinks he's a big shot, but he's just the little horn. And so apocalyptic literature like Daniel and Revelation are trying to encourage their readers to remain faithful to their understanding that the one to whom allegiance is due is the one who truly is in charge, who is God and not Antiochus or the Roman emperor.
Mm-hmm. I like this. It sort of offers a alternative view of reality. It looks like Caesar's on the throne, but then we get this grand image of God and the Lamb on the throne, and sort of the heart of this, the initial vision of Revelation.
Right.
And then it's extremely political, right? I mean, it's religious and political.
Yeah, the book of Revelation, properly understood, is really a pretty dangerous book because it challenges the status quo, not just in the first century, but for contemporary Christian readers. The book would remind us that it is not Washington or Moscow or any other power center that's really in control, and that's not the one to whom our allegiance is due. It's also a challenge when we try to meld church and country too close together, because what John reminds us is that the political forces can be the great beast that needs to be resisted rather than worshipped. You wouldn't find John setting up his country's flag in this place of worship, because those two don't go together as far as John is concerned.
Right. Yeah, and I when I think about things that people seem to worship in our American context, the economy, you know, maybe even more than our political leaders, although I think we do see some, you know, pseudo worship of some of our political leaders, but this sort of like economy is this like golden calf that we worship to the expense of all other things. And we saw that, we have seen that, I feel like, emerge, be revealed in the context of pandemic, when people said, you know, the economy is more important than people's lives, in various ways that's been expressed.
Yeah, and the book of Revelation certainly deals with the dangers of putting too much stock in economies, and the dangers of letting monetary gain become the ruler of one's lives. If you look, part of John's criticism and critique of the Roman Empire is its vast trading network and its concern for commodities, including humans as commodities, more than anything else.
This is chapter 18, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So I know from talking to you previously about this podcast, you've been invited to talk a little bit with a couple of other congregations or pastors about Revelation right now. I sent you a New York Times article that I'd read from a couple of months ago. I'm just wondering if you can tell us, why do you think Revelation is so compelling to us right now? Why is this a book that we should be reading and listening to in this present moment?
I think for readers, even those who have no in-depth understanding of the background of the book of Revelation, they rightly understand that this is a book that is trying to offer hope and encouragement in the midst of a difficult situation, a situation such as that in which we find ourselves now. One of my comments about the book of Revelation is that when one has finished reading the book of Revelation, if you have understood it properly, when you get to the end, you don't know anything more about what the future holds than you did when you started, other than the idea that God is ultimately in control. And I think that's the word of comfort that people find in the book of Revelation. And I think that is a correct understanding of the book, because John is convinced that when the dust finally settles, God is still there in the end, in the midst of all the problems of life. to me, one of the most powerful images or descriptions in the book of Revelation is when John describes God as both the Alpha and the Omega, as you know, the first and last letters of the Greek alphabet. So what John is trying to say is God is there at the beginning, but that same God who is there at the beginning will also be there at the end, as well as all the way through in between. So in times of difficulty, that can be a real word of hope and comfort for readers to recognize that as unsettling as the current situation may be, we're not in this situation alone.
Yeah, it literally feels for many of us that the world is spinning out of control. Reality feels like it's been sort of upended, or the tables have been flipped, and we don't, you know, I don't know what a week from now is going to be like, months, a year.
Well, and in one sense, not in the way that televangelists would use the phrase, but this is an apocalyptic moment in the sense that the world as we have known it is coming to an end, and we don't know what the new normal will be like. So it is a revealing moment, to take a play on the book of Revelation. It's a revealing moment for us. And a part of what that reveals for us is that a lot of the things that we have thought might have been important, we're finding are not as important as perhaps we initially thought they were. And so that we find what is really central and important to life. The major thing with the book of Revelation is, in spite of all the images of destruction and punishment that are found throughout the book, it is still a book of hope that says, in spite of all of this, God is the one who sits on the throne.
In spite of all appearances to the contrary.
Yes.
Yeah. And I appreciate this. It is a values clarifying moment, where we're forced to reflect what is most important to me, what is most important to us as a congregation, as we sort of reimagine what church looks like, and what it looks like to be the church in the world. And I think even as we see this emergent movement towards racial justice and reconciliation, you know, how does the church play into that?
I'm currently teaching a Sunday school class that's dealing with the book of Revelation. And one of the comments I made to them last week was, even in terms of the racial situation that's going on, the book of Revelation speaks to that. If you look in chapter 7 with John's vision of all those who have made it through the difficult situation and are surrounding the throne, John describes them as those from every nation, people, and tribe who are joined together. So John's vision of the people of God is an inclusive vision.
Yeah, incredibly diverse. Yeah.
Yes.
Mitchell, thank you so much for your time with us today. This has been such a rich conversation, and I'm confident that it will be well received by our podcast listeners. Thanks for taking time to join us from beautiful, sunny, hot Florida.
That's right.
We hope that you and Barb continue to do well there. We know that y'all have visited Tabernacle on a number of occasions, so y'all are known to many folks in our congregation.
Glad to do this with you.
For our podcast listeners, thank you for taking time to listen to this all the way through. We are just getting started, and Dr. Mitchell Reddish has gotten us started off on the right foot. So Mitchell, thank you again so much for taking time to join us today.
Glad to join you.
All right. Take care, everyone. Go in peace.